Hello, this is Andrew and Wolf. My topic this week is, how the heck is Apple going to switch to Swift?
I thought they already have.
Well, in some sense, but not entirely. In particular, how are they going to handle their public frameworks?
Right. That is a standing question.
Right, because if you assume that their plan is in two steps. Their plan is step one, Swift. And step two, rewrite all your frameworks in Swift. We know how they're going to do one. They're still in the process of doing one. One is going pretty well. But two is what I'm going to be talking about. So for those of you living under a rock, Swift 1.2 was released recently with Xcode 6.3 beta. Now, I looked at the blog post about it, because there is a blog post about it, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. They didn't specifically say that 1.2 itself was beta, just that Xcode was beta. Mm-hmm. But I'm assuming 1.2 is also beta. Mm-hmm. Although it's a little confusing about that. So they're still working on 1.2, but it's, you know, better than 1.1, better than 1.0. It's got a lot of things fixed. A lot of things are still broken.
And it's also kind of weird that, like, Xcode, you know, 6.3 beta, right? And last I checked, yep. Like on the App Store, the latest stable is 6.1. Like, where's 6.2? What happened to that?
Well, 6.2 is also still in beta.
Right. But it's not like Apple has parallel Xcode teams working, right? That's kind of weird here.
They do not. So it is interesting that they're doing it that way. There must be some benefit to it of them. And I would suspect, right, that Xcode 6.2 will go GM first. You will be able to send out your to submit your watch applications with 6.2. But they said, well, it's important enough that we also give you a new version of Swift. We can't jam that into the thing that's going to go GM in a couple of weeks. So we've got to do both. But yes, having two betas at once, Apple has done it before. Mm-hmm. But it definitely shows stress points in Apple, I think, the fact that they're trying to get a lot done at once. Mm-hmm. So if you decide that step one is actually all you need, then you are all done, and you could write all your apps in Swift from now on. The trouble with that, of course, is that all the frameworks you need are in Objective-C. There's the problem of the fact that they're not really designed for the language, for one. But there's also, they're not really designed for the ideas behind the language either. Andy Matushak, who was recently an Apple employee and is now at Khan Academy, has talked about this several times, the most recent of which is in a talk called Controlling Complexity in Swift, which he did at an NS meetup in San Francisco. I put a link to the video on realm.io. He talks about how you want to get mutable state out of your application and do that by using... He's actually rather gentle about sort of the functional programming ideas that you can include in your applications. And he also did some of this even at Apple. There was a WWDC session that he and, was it Colin Barrett?
Yeah, I believe so.
We're doing. And I believe I mentioned it before. I don't remember the link right now. I'll put that in the show notes as well. And so, you know, he's not going hardcore on us, as other people in my Twitter feed have been known to do. But he is making it clear that there is a different mindset behind it. And if you say to yourself, well, okay, being more functional, using less mutable state is something you want to do when you write Swift code, then the frameworks that you're going to be dealing with when writing your Mac and iOS applications, they're full of mutable state. There are, you know, views, view controllers, drawing primitives, core data objects. Anywhere you look,
yeah,
you create objects, modify them, and then look at the results, mm-hmm, for the tasks that you want to do. So you can't, if you keep doing that, you'll basically be using a foreign language to have the same old boring conversations, is my
this
metaphor there.
Reminds me of the Android France thing.
Yes. Well, I think that's the end for the metaphors, but we'll see. So they have to rewrite the frameworks. And there are actually some precedents for this in what Apple has done. You can look at QuickTime, in that the QuickTime API was originally in C. And then they came out with a Qt kit. Of course, they've since come out with AVF Foundation. Qt kit was an Objective-C framework that they wrote as a new thing to use. and it didn't actually have all the things that the QuickTime API had, because, of course, the QuickTime API was ancient and giant and, you know, did everything that you ever needed to do in QuickTime. And so what they did was they said, well, we'll ship a smaller subset of it so that most people can use the easier Objective-C APIs, because most people are using Objective-C right now. The trouble was that, of course, was that if you did need to use some of that extra functionality that they didn't put in the framework, then you had to go back to C. So if that's their model, for one, it's not great, because that means probably for the last 10% of your application, you will need to go back to basically Objective-C bridging to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's probably kind of our best case scenario, because my thesis is, in the few minutes I'm going to take up with this, is even that seems really hard and really unlikely for them to do, because Apple has dozens of frameworks that do all sorts of things. And there's only one Swift team, or one, you know, set of Swift teams that's working on this project for them. The best Apple projects are the ones that could be done by small teams very quickly. That's how they love to shoot things through. Okay, we're going to do this great new thing. You know, even the iPhone team is relatively small when it started, and of course they almost killed themselves making the thing. But you know what they do? You know, focused effort, get it done. But this is something completely different. This is, okay, everybody now do something very differently. And I just wonder how the heck they're going to do it. Because, okay, let's look at that. Let's say, okay, they don't have enough people for the Swift team to rewrite everybody's functions, everybody's frameworks. So the Swift team will teach those people how to write Swift code, the concepts behind it, everything else, and they'll write the frameworks. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the equivalent of them shipping their prototype. Right, because these people's learning experience will be writing the frameworks that, you know, thousands and thousands of new developers will be using.
Sure.
I'm not sure I like that scenario.
That you're right. That is problematic.
That's problematic. Okay. Scenario two. They make their prototype, but they don't ship it. Mm-hmm. They spend a couple of years working on the versions that will be better. That means for a couple of years, we don't get any updates to our current frameworks. Mm. That's both not great. And I also think that Apple doesn't really do that. They don't say, we'll see you in 3 years. They always want to ship something. They want to do incremental things. I just don't see how that agrees with their problem that they're facing right now. So that's basically my topic is, how are they going to do this? And I don't have an answer just yet. You know, maybe they'll say, well, we'll just rewrite one framework. We'll rewrite UIKit. UIKit is huge, right? Even that is going to take a long time to do. Maybe break off a smaller framework and do that.
Yeah, maybe some of the stuff that people aren't using so greatly, and that could be their learning experience frameworks.
But that also isn't how Apple operates. They're not going to say, well, here's this great, great new language. We want you to do everything in it. Now we're going to release, you know, IADS in Swift. You know, it's just not the way they work. So, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
I thought you were going to talk about like the C++ ABI vtable issues, but yeah.
This, oh no!
This
is more interesting.
you acting like vtables aren't interesting.
Okay, my bad.
I agree. There is definite goals against the culture of Apple, any which way they do it. So it's going to be interesting which path they choose. And it really also kind of it comes down to me is like, you know, there's a lot of political clout behind Swift. And I mean, the fact that Apple came out and very publicly announced it to the world at large, and Tim Cook is talking about it, tells me that, you know, this is they're wearing this on their shoulder. You know, this is not something that's in a dub session for nerds to geek out on. This is something that they very publicly committed to. So they want a showpiece here. They're not going to settle for this the IAD being rewritten. So there is political clout here. They've very publicly committed to it, I think, to their disadvantage. Unfortunately, this culture then it doesn't really fit with the rest of Apple, as you mentioned. So I think it's just going to be a really bumpy ride for a long time.
And if, you know, if they're smart enough to have come up with some way to get around this that I just haven't thought of, more power to them. Yeah. I'll look forward to it.
Yeah, yeah. Dynamic translation. But even that, I mean, you just can't even do
it. They wouldn't do it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Which actually kind of is a good segue to my topic.
There you go.
Okay. I'm going to figure out how much the Apple Watch will cost based on the amount of gold in it from first principles on the value of gold. So it's going to be kind of extended topic. No, I'm not going to talk about that at all, because who the heck cares how much Apple Watch costs? But apparently that's all the podcasts want to talk about now.
Yes.
So
we are not
we are all not the going other to talk podcasts. About that. Yes. Instead, I'm going to talk about Bitcode for software distribution.
Woo!
A nice non-topical topic. Although it is a little bit topical in that the iWatch obviously has its own processor in it. And yes. Apple, I don't think, has even told us what processor is in it. And I'm hoping it's probably some sort of, you know, ARM processor. Because, as I mentioned before, it's a dark matter. It's everywhere.
Well, ARM on your wrist.
that gets recursive, doesn't it?
Sorry, go on.
Now with the one of the reasons we don't care about whether what processors in the iWatch is because if you look at the iWatch SDK, which I know you have, I have not personally written any prototype apps in it yet, but your code does not actually execute on the watch itself. It's correct. It's you're controlling what's on screen, but for mere mortal developers, your code does not fly across the wire and get executed on the watch.
You're basically using distributed objects.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're not running code on it yet. It's kind of like the what did they call the thing? A sweet solution or whatever, where you could write HTML apps on the original iPhone.
Something like that.
I don't remember anymore. But I'm sure that the time will come where you actually can have a little fragment of code running on an iWatch itself. Maybe it's 6 years from now or something. I don't know.
Well, they said it would be the next thing coming up.
That's true. They did. This year. Yeah, that's a good point. I guess
which strikes me as strikes me as being a little unrealistic. But
so we don't know what processor that's targeting. And then there's been consistent rumors about ARM-based Macs, and there are definite pros and cons to that type of stuff. But Apple has probably the most successful story of switching processors that anyone has had. I would say maybe the next one that's as successful was oddly Next, which had a lot of different platform support in their operating system once they went to OpenStep. So once you get the fusion of the two, it's definitely this is a company that is willing and able to jump from processor to processor. And obviously, Apple had the 68K emulator, which featured dynamic recompilation. And I'll put a link to that, the Wikipedia entry in that. That's interesting. Later on for the PowerPC, they had Transitive Corporation. I want to say Transitive Technology, but I'm pretty sure it's Transitive Corporation, which when I was researching this, I found out was actually acquired by IBM in June 2009. And they seem pretty much dead nowadays, which is probably not too surprising. The need, you know, now that Apple doesn't even ship Rosetta anymore, I guess the market isn't really clamoring for that type of stuff right now anyway. They use a technology called binary translation, which was kind of a more staticky type thing, but also definitely had runtime components. And this is something that I want to mention on the show for a long time, but I have no reason to talk about it, but I do now. That one of the first things I heard about like this binary translation functionality was something called I don't know if I'm supposed to pronounce exclamation mark or not, but it's FX exclamation mark 32, which was a digital equipment corporation, which again, Brenner will show favorite digital equipment corporation that no one else talks about. It was a technology that allowed x86 Windows 32 apps to run on Windows NT on their Alpha processor. And it was very cool first time, like mid-90s. And it was like, it kind of blew my mind when it came out. It was really almost inconceivable to me that they could make it work as well as they did. That's pretty awesome. So I think that there's if you're looking at kind of like these, Apple has to deal with a lot of different processors. And this looks like something that's not going away. And they've been pretty much doing it piecemeal, that they've been, you know, they ship the 68K emulator, they do the transitive thing with the Rosetta, that and we talk, you know, you just mentioned in your topic that Apple's not one to kind of like, you know, wait 3 years to do highfalutin things. They want to kind of ship incrementally. And so the, you know, 68K emulator was a great way to get PowerPC software out and going, even though like the original Power Macs were actually slower than the 68K ones because they ran precious little native code, but they got faster and faster as more and more code went PowerPC.
Right. I mean, it was almost too good
right.
a solution.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. So I think that if Apple has been laying the groundwork for a new type of technology that I think is pretty much ripe now. And the idea here is that you can have, instead of shipping, you know, native instructions on the Mac, we know them as FAT binaries. I guess on iOS nowadays, we even have, you can ship FAT binaries, both 32-bit and 64-bit in yes. one Mako executable. So that you know, we have this history of shipping like dual architecture, triple architecture type stuff in one binary types. And I think the time has come, and Apple's laid the technical foundation to kind of sidestep this altogether, and instead of shipping native code, shipping, you know, that one level of indirection that solves all of computer science's problems, and that's bitcode, which is a technology of LLVM. And when I first heard bitcode, I thought, you know, don't they mean bytecode? And so I will include the Wikipedia definition here. I guess I'll actually quoted here. Bytecode, also known as P-code, portable code, is a form of instruction set designed for efficient execution by a software interpreter. And so this is, there's actually, has a rich history of this type of stuff. The earliest I know about is P-code machine, which was the UCSD P-code machine, which was basically it was interpreted Pascal. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like walking your Pascal code and trying to figure out what to do. Instead, the compiler would turn into an instruction stream and would execute it. As part of this research, I also came upon this other tidbit of kind of P-code machines, which I didn't know about, which is Sweet 16, which has apparently to do with Apple history, Apple II history, which I'll quote from Wikipedia here. Sweet 16 is an interpreted bytecode language invented by Steve Wozniak and implemented as part of the integer basic ROM in the Apple II series of computers. It is created because Wozniak needed to manipulate 16-bit pointer data in his implementation of BASIC, and the Apple II was an 8-bit computer. Sweet 16 runs about 1/10 the speed of equivalent native 6502 code. So, way to go, EdgeCases, for referencing this bytecode language for the Apple II. This is apparently a bit of a throwback episode. But if you... So, bytecode is pretty well understood. And bytecode is not really meant for, like, software interpretation. Instead, bytecode is really, in terms of LLVM, is two things. I think they did a good job that they should name it something different, because if you say bytecode, people get the wrong idea. And so, number one, bytecode is a generic bitstream container format. So, I'll quote from a page on LLVM site for bytecode. The bitstream format is an abstract encoding of structured data, very similar to XML in some ways. Like XML, bitstream files contain tags and SS structures and can parse the file without having to understand the tags. Unlike XML, the bitstream format is a binary encoding, and unlike XML, it provides a mechanism for the file to self-describe abbreviations, which are effectively size optimizations for the content. So I did some cursory looking into the file format of it, and it seems pretty sane in terms of just being a generic container format for data. It seems pretty good.
Like QuickTime for compilers?
essentially, yeah. I mean, you can pretty much jam any information in here, and it actually seems a lot better than the QuickTime file format. And so Bitstream is this generic container format, and when I talk about bitcode is this generic file format. And so we know about intermediate representations. Intermediate representations. So you have your source code. Those turns into abstract syntax trees, which the compiler then works on. And it basically, instead of like old school compilers would generate perhaps native code directly, intermediate representation is this kind of this higher level description coded to the LLVM, the low level virtual machine. that is structured side architecture that can be translated into a native encoding. So it's kind of this like intermediary step. So bytecode is not only this generic container file format, but also it is the intermediate representation encoding of. So if you take an intermediate representation and you want to write out the disk, this is the bits that land on the bladder. Or I guess flip the bits in the chip with SSDs nowadays. And while we're talking about bytecode, I also want to mention that it seems very very amenable to hacking. And one of the in the previous episode, episode 78, Indexing with Clang, you talked about the limitations of using libclang. And I think you pretty much got it working to your satisfaction, right, Andrew?
I mean, I got it working.
Yeah. I mean, and part of the problem with that is that LLVM and Clang have this C++ API, and you talked about how they don't want to expose it directly and how it's constantly shifting, and they give you this kind of like this procedural simplifies API that allows you to interact with it that is less moving.
Well, that they commit to, that they won't change.
Yes. And unfortunately, there's this one of Apple's earlier language efforts called Dylan, and so Swift people, you know, remember that Apple has a history of loving and leaving languages, so don't get too cocky. So Dylan, short for dynamic language, this is still an ongoing project, and they want to be able to interact more effectively with C++ code. And so what they end up doing is that because they were running into limitations of what they want to be able to do with libclang, is that they actually are using bytecode generation to interact with Clang at the file format level, at the data level. And that's been effective for them. And I will include a link to that. It's kind of out-of-the-box thinking. I think it's pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah. You can bypass the limitations of libclang by writing bytecode directly.
Well, it's like old Apple meets new Apple.
Good point.
Pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. There is a project that kind of, I would say, achieves what I want to achieve with my idea of shipping bytecode as a software distribution package. And this is Google Native Client, which I'll include a link to the development page. Or NACL, I guess, is the shorthand for it, but also called Native Client. And a Native Client is actually really technically cool. It uses this thing called software fault isolation that does static machine code analysis. And what it does is that essentially it takes the x86 code, at least in the first version, and it would scan it. It basically includes it understands x86 instructions, and it would analyze it and see if it does something funky, like jumping into the middle of instructions. And because if you do that, then all bets are off, because then you can reinterpret the byte stream to be another whole set of instructions. So basically, it kind of like looks at the instruction stream and makes sure that it looks sane. And then it x86 is famous for its really crazy segmented architecture system. And they actually take advantage of that to run, you could take this x86 native code and they verify it, and then they set up the segment registers, and they just put the program counter pointer at it, and they let it run, and it's safe. And so you get all the speed advantages of running x86 natively with safety advantages of sandbox. Technically, it's very impressive. And they shipped for x86 first, and now they've added ARM, x86, 64, and even MIPS. If Syracuse has this like file system thing, apparently with us, it needs to be like, or at least me, it needs to be like me mentioning DEC or MIPS. I don't know how many times I mentioned MIPS. more times than I ever thought I would. So native client is really technically interesting, but that was only like their first crack at it. Then Google shipped Pnacle, which is basically uses what I'm describing here, where you ship the LLVM IR in bitcode format, so the bitcode file, and you could ship native code. And when you install the native client code, they are running LLVM that takes it and compiles it. This is known as ahead of time compilation or ahead of time translation, and they will compile it for your own specific processor. And it turns out that this is news to me, that when I was researching this, that if you want to ship quote unquote native code with your Google Chrome Web Store thing, I don't even know what to call these things. It turns out that's a requirement for their store, is that you need to ship it in this Pnacle format. So Google actually has been doing this for, I think, a few years now. So it's not just a kind of a pie-in-the-sky idea that this has been deployed and seems to be working well for them. I mean, obviously, you know, the Chrome Web Store isn't setting the world on fire. But it shows that technically this could be a way forward. And Apple already has technology that uses LLVM as part of a software deployment technology. Core image kernels, they use LLVM to compile either for the CPU or GPU. Ruby Motion, which used to be kind of Apple, but it now isn't, but it definitely has a lot of Apple flavor, uses ahead of time compilation, although be it on the developer side of things, that you don't you're not shipping like a .app that or a .apa that has its own like LLVM embedded. You do it when you actually are building the app. And of course, probably the most famous recent example is WebKit's FTL engine that also uses LLVM as yet another stage of optimizing JavaScript. So it turns out that I forget when they released it for iOS. I think it was iOS 7, but it might have been iOS 8. But so your iPhone is already humming along with LLVM embedded in it, kind of doing this ahead of time. I don't know if you really can call it ahead of time, because this is a pretty dynamic process, but it is using LLVM to dynamically target the code that's running. So, in terms of downsides for why Apple shouldn't end up, the upsides are pretty clear, right? Because if the ARM Max, you know, were announced at the upcoming Apple event, we have a problem here. Like, we can compile yet again for this one new architecture, and you know, we've been through the ringer here a few times, so really, frankly, it wouldn't be that hard. We just, again, our binaries would grow another ISA in there, and you know, we could deal with that. But for really the same amount of effort, Apple could probably solve the problem once and for all, and could, if we were to target bitcode instead, then when the ARM Max came out, then OS X would just grow the ability to dynamically compile apps as you install them. And this would be a one-time thing, so it wouldn't slow you down at runtime. And then what's interesting about this is that Apple has the ability to do things like make custom processors that aren't even ARM or x86 or what have you, that they could start even making some lower-level technical trade-offs, where they can morph the instruction set architecture to whatever they want. And this is actually pretty exciting for me, because we have this like co-evolutionary thing, where the machines we run today are really fast at running C-based code, because that's what most code is written in. And C-based code was kind of targeting like the PDP-8. And so we have kind of stagnated we've slowly been growing our register file and stuff like that. But man, it's just like we're kind of like they're codependent on each other, that it's hard to get some real processor innovation going here because of the low-level nature of this stuff. And, you know, obviously the transitive stuff with this binary translation, it's this type of stuff where you can write one processor ISA to another is feasible, and there have been notable successes with it. However, if we actually had a higher level intermediate representation of LLVM, which is known good for optimization phases, because this is what's being used for production code, I think this was kind of a higher level concept. It would allow higher level optimizations and would potentially allow us to get past the stagnation where everything has to be at ARM or everything has to be x86. And we could actually start moving software forward. And a lot of the micro optimizations that processors have to make are because they have to run old code. This would actually allow it, potentially to throw away entire optimization units that are done at runtime at the microprocessor level that could be done where you can fine-tune the native code generated from the bit code. And so this could actually be, it's, I don't want to say it'd be a, you know, a great advantage, because I think RISC versus CISC has been kind of illustrated that those, and that it doesn't really matter that much. It matters who has the biggest fabs to win these types of things. But, you know, Apple's been a company that's been very concerned about energy usage for a long time, and that's been one of their advantages for a while. And if you can throw away chunks of processor that are thus irrelevant because you have better software architecture, that might actually, maybe that has software, I mean, energy use ramifications. Maybe we get 2% more out of our phone. Maybe it's not worth it. But kind of the larger point here is that there's no reason not to do it that I see now. About the only real downside I see is that it might make it easier to reverse engineer software. But frankly, you know, I just used Hopper to open up keychain access today, and that was really easy. Objective-C is pretty easy to crack, so I don't see that as a real speed bump there. So, what do you think, Andrew? Would you sign up for this brave new world of shipping bitcode?
No.
What?
Okay, my big objection to this is what you're asking me to do is to ship code that I have never, to ship an app that I have never directly run on your processor. Because what you're saying is I'm going to ship something and then you're going to be responsible for compiling it down to the bytes that go on, you know, whatever new processor, whatever new device that comes out. And I have to trust that you're going to do that and it's going to ship and it's going to be perfect without my ever having to tweak it. And I don't trust technology well enough to believe that that's going to happen with my app, with the app that I want to sell and that I want to have people have a good impression of the first time they run it. I mean, this is the problem that people were seeing with, you know, running on the iPad the first time when the iPad wasn't out. They were using the simulator first. And, you know, they found that things were different when they finally got their devices. And, you know, was it the end of the world that they were different? No. But what you're saying, though, is I should be able to take my old app, you know, 3-year-old app, and then, you know, 3 years from now, you'll have a new processor, and I'll have to trust that that translation from the IR to the bytecode, to the compiled code, compiled bits, bytes, whatever we're calling it, will be good, will work. And I think that's combinatorial complexity. Because what you're saying is your system will be able to make everything right for every piece of code that anyone could ever write. And I just think that that's too much to ask of a compiler, too much to ask of any system. That's why we run things. That's why we have testers for things, because you can never just expect things to be right from the system. You have to see for yourself. And this assumes you don't need to do that. And I think that's unrealistic.
I'm glad you brought this up, because I believe I actually thought about this point, and I just forgot to write it down. So, you know, way to be inside my head there. We did mention something similar to this in episode 118, Don't Get Cocky Kid, where we talked about the native WDEFs for how you couldn't test the code before it shipped and it being buggy. I agree with you. That is a concern. However, I will also point you back to episode 73, Sequential Consistency, where you're already living in the world that you said you can't tolerate. The processor that's... Your x86
you're telling me. But yes, go on.
The x86 processor that you running on your Mac, it is a fabrication. It is doing exactly what you're saying, but it's doing it at the microprocessor level. Now, granted, Microsoft's processor people, for whatever reason, maybe they have better discipline than they do. Maybe they have different processes. Maybe they just have a different problem set than we do, which is the kind of the lately. I used to have a real kind of stigma saying, thinking that electrical engineers are better engineers than software people, but I think they actually have a different problem set than we do. But that's what it's doing, man. It's there's this fictional processor that existed in the past, and that's what we're all writing code for and compiling to, and that gets torn apart at runtime, and gets re-executed to fit the native model of these modern processors.
Well sure, but I can still, it goes through all that, and I see the results directly when I test it on my Mac.
Right.
I'm seeing the whole cycle. Mm-hmm. And so that's enough for me.
Seems to be working for Google Chrome with their native.
Well, it's working for them because they're targeting existing platforms. They're not saying, give me your IR code and now I'll compile it to something you've never seen. They're saying, give me your IR code and we'll compile it to x86 and you can try it before you ship your code to us.
Okay. I see there's a bit of nuance there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. I have to, yeah. So maybe it isn't the slam dunk that I mentioned, but I still think it's worth, we should do it. I have a gut feeling. Is that enough?
It's a good start.
Okay. Thanks for giving me that.
All right. And we'll see you next time.